Bible Worm, Bible Worm, reading the Bible with Bible Worm.
Welcome to Bible Worm, getting to the core of the biblical text. I'm Dr. Robert Williamson, professor of religious studies at Hendricks College and the founding pastor of Mercy Community Church in Little Rock.
And I'm Dr. Amy Robertson, director of lifelong learning at Congregation Or Hadash in Sandy Springs, Georgia. We're here every week to discuss the biblical text, both as biblical scholars and as people of faith, one Jewish and one Christian.
This week, we turn to the Joseph story in Genesis chapters 37 and 50, exploring the complicated family dynamics of Jacob and his 11 sons. We discuss how a sense of scarcity, whether of grain or of a father's love, can create divisions in families and among peoples who would otherwise get along. We discuss the idea that God can turn evil plans toward good outcomes if only we can learn to trust divine promises. And we think about the relative value of love and justice and how love unevenly applied can lead to disastrous outcomes. Thanks for joining us. Hey, Amy, how are you this week?
I am doing okay.
You always start out so like, I am doing... And then the adjective is okay.
As my we like to say in my family, I am medium to medium minus.
I like that. My family says fair to middling. I guess we're from South Carolina.
Like fair to middling. I like that. I like fair to middling.
All right. So, Amy, last time we talked, we were in Genesis 15. God had just reconfirmed the promise to Abraham. Yeah. Now we have Abraham's grandson, Jacob, and his, in this story, 11 sons who are having some family dynamics.
Issues. They're having some dynamics. They are.
So
yes.
What do we need to know to get us from Genesis 15 to Genesis 37?
So the first thing I want to say, just sort of like as an overarching thing that will apply in all the different generations, is there is a standing tradition that the biblical authors know, that the firstborn son of a man's vigor, to quote Deuteronomy, has a larger inheritance in terms of both status and wealth.
Yeah.
And so this theme comes up in pretty much all the generations that we encounter in Genesis and is mostly upended, right? Genesis likes to play with this tradition and favor the underdog. So Abraham goes on to have two sons, Isaac and Ishmael. His lineage is through his second son, who is Isaac, who is the firstborn with his wife, Sarah.
Yeah, and that's interesting, too, because Jacob, who is the father in the story we're about to read in Genesis 37, is the younger son of his father, Isaac. His twin brother, technically, Esau, but Esau is the one who was born first. And so Jacob comes from that sort of pattern of the favoring of younger sons.
Yes, and even just to add a little bit to that, Jacob then marries two wives who are sisters. The elder is Leah and the younger is Rachel. And the text tells us that he loved Rachel, the younger one, more, that he loved Rachel and is sort of tricked into marrying Leah because she's the older sister.
Yeah.
And then Leah hopes to earn her husband's esteem by birthing him many, many sons. Rachel has more difficulty having children and eventually bears two sons later in life, the first of whom is Joseph. So Joseph is the firstborn son of Jacob's beloved wife, but is actually Jacob's 11th son.
So we're in Genesis chapter 37, starting in verse 2. This is the story of the family of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was shepherding the flock with his brothers. He was a helper to the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives, and Joseph brought a bad report of them to their father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than any other of his children, because he was the son of his old age, and he had made him a long robe with sleeves. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. So this is our introduction to Jacob's family, and you can already see just in these couple of verses, there are some complicated family dynamics that are going.
This is no Brady Bunch situation. Yeah.
So we get the notice. So Israel loved Joseph. And of course, Israel there is just, that's what Jacob's name is changed to back at the Jabbok River. Mm-hmm. So what that means is Jacob loved Joseph more than any other of his children. And so we've got this sort of clear statement from the narrator that Joseph is the favorite. Mm-hmm. And then we get the notice because he was the son of his old age. Any thoughts about why you would favor the son of your old age?
I mean, it's not a particularly deep thought. It's just, it seems a little more miraculous, maybe?
I also think, as you were gesturing earlier, although I don't, it's not said here, that Rachel is the favored wife and mm-hmm. Joseph is the first son of the favored wife. And, you know, they've been married for a long time now. And finally, in Jacob's old age, he has a son from the wife he has loved since he laid eyes on her all the way mm-hmm. back at the well.
Yeah. Rachel is described as his ahuvah, as his beloved.
Yeah.
And Leah is described as senuah, which literally means hated. And the rabbis struggle with this a little bit. Like, did Jacob really hate Leah?
Yeah.
And they come to the conclusion that, no, he didn't hate Leah, but Leah felt hated because, you know, like, if it's clear that your parent or your spouse loves someone the most, but yeah. loves you too.
yeah.
It feels like hated.
Yeah.
You know, whether there's no, you know, like there's, you don't want to be loved too. You want to be
loved.
The most loved if yeah. there's like a differential between them. And so I find it really interesting here that there's so much talk about hating and it'll go on, but sort of how the brothers hate Joseph in a way that seems pretty much like real hate, not just like what we're talking about with how Jacob might have felt about Leah or how Jacob might have felt about his other sons.
Now, the other thing I wanted to point to in this first couple of verses is that Jacob made for Joseph, my translation, the NRSV, a long robe with sleeves. Sometimes you hear that as a multicolored robe or a technicolor mm-hmm. dream coat or something like that. This robe is important and it's going to come back in the story.
Yeah.
What should we know about this ornamented tunic?
I mean, the first thing that comes to my mind is just throughout the Joseph story, there are a lot of costume changes. Like as Joseph moves sort of in and out of different communities and statuses within those communities, he changes his clothes a lot. And so this ornamented tunic to me is just sort of an indicator that though he is among his brothers, it very clearly marks him as of a different status. He's fancy.
Yeah.
That's what it tells me. He's fancy.
He's fancy. Yeah.
What would you want to say about this tunic?
Well, one of my favorite details here is, so the Hebrew there is ketonet pasim, mm-hmm. which probably means a long sleeved robe, although we're not entirely sure what that's getting at. But the other place that it's used in the Hebrew Bible is in 2 Samuel 13, where it's described as the clothing that the virgin daughters of a king wears. So Joseph is wearing like his princess robes. So but I like what you're saying, where the robe is marking him as sort of in an elevated status. Maybe he gets treated a little bit like a prince or princess, like he's mm-hmm. kind of the royalty of the family in that sense. Mm-hmm. In an interesting kind of way, it's foreshadowing the end of this story where he actually is going to be royalty. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot going on, and it's a marker of his father's favoritism. Mm-hmm. Now, the last thing in verse 4 that you pointed to a little bit earlier, his brothers saw that their father loved him, and they hated him, and they could not speak peaceably to him. Any thoughts about that family dynamic that we get there?
I mean, I don't know if I have any thoughts beyond sort of what I already shared, but it's, you know, when his brothers saw that his father loved him more than any of his other brothers, like once there is a clear differential
yeah.
in love coming from a parent, it creates conflict even if no one wants conflict.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, so it's not that they hate him because of like who he is exactly. Although he does turn out to be a little
not yet.
He's pretty difficult. But yeah, but it's the differential of affection from the father that creates the hatred among the siblings.
Yeah.
I think that's important. Okay, moving on to verse 5. Once Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. He said to them, "Listen to this dream that I dreamed. There we were, binding sheaves in the field. Suddenly, my sheaf rose and stood upright. Then your sheaves gathered around it and bowed down to my sheaf." His brothers said to him, "Are you indeed to reign over us? Are you indeed to have dominion over us?" So they hated him even more because of his dreams and his words. So what do you make of this dream that Joseph has had, and for some reason chosen to share with his brothers. Like, this is the kind of thing you sort of keep to yourself, you know?
Yeah, it is. And he is not young. He is 17 years old.
That's
he really
right.
should know better at this point. And, you know, this is not on the topic of dreams, which I can talk about in a minute, but it just, again, sort of like underscores how little these people understand each other. Like, though they're in a family together, he doesn't understand his brother's experience, how painful it might be for them.
Yeah.
That his father favors him in this way. So anyway, dreams. I mean, Joseph is, in the patriarchs before we have met, God communicates pretty directly.
Yeah.
And in the Joseph story, God prefers dreams. Mm-hmm. Right. And Joseph, over the course of time, becomes a master dream interpreter. And in this dream in particular, everyone, it seems like the brothers, understandably, are interested in the part where they have to bow down.
Yeah.
That makes sense. But it's interesting that no one really notices the wheat portion
right.
of it. Like, it's the wheat bowing down to the wheat.
Yeah.
Which also turns out to be a really important and true thing. Like, the situation in which Joseph rises into actual power over his brothers is about availability of food.
Yeah.
What would you add in here?
No, I love that. I think that's really important. Like, the story actually, as we're going to see, is going to turn out kind of exactly this way.
Yeah, pretty much.
Although by the time it turns out this way, I think Joseph maybe has a different attitude about it than he has right here.
Mm-hmm.
But these dreams are not the stuff of just like fanciful, like, imaginings where this punk kid is like telling his brothers, ha ha, I'm better than you. Although, I mean, I think it is that, or at least mm-hmm. you can understand why his brothers receive it that way. But this actually is a dream that is revealing something about the future that is to come. And so in some ways, like, what they're jealous about is like the reality of...
is real.
What's
right.
about
what they're
to
jealous
unfold.
About is real. It's not yeah. imagined.
That's exactly right. Okay, so we're going to skip down then to 17b. So basically, the brothers have gone away to work in another field, and now Joseph is going to go and find them. And so just geographically, we've moved away from the sort of family home, which allows for some dynamics to play out that might not play out if they were like in the backyard.
Yeah, I'd hope not.
So in 17b, so Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. They saw him from a distance, and before he came near to them, they conspired to kill him. They said to one another, "Here comes this dreamer. Come now, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. Then we shall say that a wild animal has devoured him, and we shall see what will become of his dreams." But when Reuben heard it, he delivered him out of their hands, saying, "Let us not take his life." Reuben said to them, "Shed no blood. Throw him into this pit here in the wilderness, but lay no hand on him, that he might rescue him out of their hand and restore him to his father." So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the long robe with sleeves that he wore, and they took him and threw him into a pit. The pit was empty. There was no water in it. What do you make of those family dynamics there that are going on?
I mean, I guess there's a couple things. First of all, it, you know, I think it bears underscoring that it seems like all the brothers are off somewhere, and Joseph alone is away from them, and his father says, "Go find your brothers."
Yeah.
And he has to go really far.
Yeah.
And then when his brothers see him, they I mean, like, there's hated and then there's hated.
Yeah.
And they want to kill him.
Yeah, this is not just like we're not going to speak to each other at Thanksgiving. Like,
right.
This is like for reals. Yeah.
And then it's the firstborn, Reuben, who in some ways you would think might hate him the most because he's the one who's supposed to have this special status. But he's the one who almost steps up into this, like, the big brother role. You know, he steps up into the big brother role and says, "We can't kill him. Like, let's just throw him into the pit." And then in his own mind, he doesn't tell the brothers, "I'll rescue him later."
Yeah, right.
But in his own mind, this is just sort of like a, you know, a holding area for him so that he can restore him later to his father. So, I mean, that's pretty good big brothering.
And I mean, I'm not clear whether he does that because Joseph is his brother, or whether because he loves Joseph, or because he loves his father. But I mean, in some ways, his motivations don't really matter.
Yeah, and before they throw him in this pit, They pull off his fancy clothes.
Why do you think we're told that so specifically?
I mean, that's a good question. Like, I mean, it will come up later in the plot. The brothers will use the robe. But it also, I mean, if we think of, again, Joseph's sort of costume changes throughout the story as markers of his status, you know, his status is changing now. He's going from the beloved and most cared for son of his father to being thrown in a pit, you know, facing at least an immediate fate that is profoundly diminished. I don't know if that's the right word, but his status is profoundly diminished.
Now, there's some irony in verse 20 when the brothers say, let us throw him in the pit and we shall see what will become of his dreams, right? At this moment in the text, what's happening is they're saying, like, his dreams are going to come to nothing.
Mm-hmm.
But when you read the story all the way through, like, this throwing in the pit is actually what leads to, in this interesting way, the completion of those dreams.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So picking up in 25, then they sat down to eat. And looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels carrying gum, balm, and resin on their way to carry it down to Egypt. Then Judah said to his brothers, what profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him, for he is our brother, our own flesh. And his brothers agreed. When some Midianite traders passed by, they drew Joseph up, lifting him out of the pit, and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver. And they took Joseph to Egypt. Okay, so in the previous little bit of text, we had Reuben coming up with one plan to spare Joseph's life. Here we have Judah coming up with another plan that spares Joseph's life. Mm-hmm. But they're pretty different plans. What do you make of Judah's plan here?
Okay, so they've thrown him in the pit. They're having their picnic. And they're still trying to figure out what to do. And so Judah says, it seems like they're still contemplating killing him. Like, they've put him in the pit as a holding cell. And Judah says, well, better than, we shouldn't kill him. Like, sort of as Reuben said, like, he is our own flesh. But we could sell him to passing traders, and then that would really get him out of the picture.
So we still accomplish getting him out of the picture. We don't have to kill him, so there's not blood on our hands. And we're going to make 20 pieces of silver in profit. Whereas if we just left him out here, then we wouldn't benefit from it financially. So we've added a financial component.
Although, so in verse 28, it says, when Midianite traders passed by, they pulled Joseph out of the pit. They sold Joseph for 20 pieces of silver to the Ishmaelites who brought Joseph to Egypt. So when it says they pulled Joseph up out of the pit, do you read that as the brothers pulled him out when the Midianites passed by, or the Midianites pulled him out and sold him to the Ishmaelites?
I read that as the brothers pulled him out and sold him to the Midianites, who are sometimes in this text being called Ishmaelites. So in my mind, there's only one band of foreign traders.
There's a little ambiguity
in the text about where they're from.
The question for me is, do the brothers know what happened to Joseph? Like, did they do this, or did this all happen while they were having their picnic?
I have always read it, and I think I still want to read it as the brothers have sold him into slavery in Egypt to either some Midianites or to some Ishmaelites. And so they do know what happened to him.
Mm-hmm.
But now I see what you're saying about your interpretation in 29, because it says when Reuben returned to the pit and saw Joseph wasn't in the pit, he tore his clothes.
Yeah. So somebody again, Reuben seems not to know what happened.
Yeah.
But some other brothers could have pulled him out and sold. Yeah, I mean,
so you could Reuben imagine this as Reuben has one plan, which is to restore him to his father, and Judah has another plan, which is to sell him to the Ishmaelites, and Reuben doesn't know about this plan, so some brothers carry out the one plan while Reuben is not aware.
Reuben's picnicking on his own.
Or you could read it as they are all conspiring about what to do, and some other bands of traitors come along and take care of
it. Yeah.
I'm with you now. I might be about to be persuaded. Okay, 29. Uh-oh. When Reuben returned to the pit and saw that Joseph was not in the pit, he tore his clothes. He returned to his brothers and said, the boy is gone, and where can I turn? Then they took Joseph's robe, slaughtered a goat, and dipped the robe in the blood. They had the long robe with sleeves taken to their father, and they said, this we have found. See now whether it is your son's robe or not. He recognized it and said, it is my son's robe. A wild animal has devoured him. Joseph is without doubt torn to pieces. Then Jacob tore his garments and put sackcloth on his loins and mourned for his son many days. So it's interesting to me that the brothers, they don't actually lie to their father in this story. It's kind of interesting. Like, they've done this whole thing has happened. Either they've done it or it has happened. But all they really say to him is, see whether this is your son's robe or not.
Yeah.
And then Jacob fills in the details.
The story. You certainly are right to point out that they mislead their father without expressly lying to him. Although it does seem, again, like a kind of, you know, it's the kind of thing that my kids would do. And I'd be like, no, that still counts.
Yeah. Like, yeah, no, I don't mean to say that what they're doing is like on
the
up and
up.
No, I know
you're not saying their hands are clean of this. But it's interesting sort of the lengths they go not to tell their father Joseph has been killed.
Yeah. So the narrative lectionary now is going to skip us all the way down to the end of the Joseph story in chapter 50. What is your sort of shorthand version of what we need to know about the rest of the Joseph story in order to make sense of chapter 50?
Well, my very general summary is Joseph winds up in Egypt. He has many ups and downs there, but he eventually winds up in the court of the Pharaoh because he's a good dream interpreter. He is put in charge of conserving food during the famine, which was predicted by Pharaoh's dream. The brothers come to Egypt because of the famine. And so then that leads to a reunion with Joseph and his family that sort of happens in fits and spurts and with a great deal of, I want to say, like, agony on their part. Like, the brothers start to feel all the feelings about what they have done.
So in this text now, in chapter 50, Jacob has just died, and the brothers are kind of having this final moment, like, they're dealing with their father's death, and they're like, are we going to reconcile, or are we not going to reconcile? And then we get this kind of closing family dynamic about reflecting as older and wiser people, now knowing what has happened in the intervening years, looking back at the events of chapter 37 and trying to process it basically as a family. Mm-hmm. So picking up in verse 15 of chapter 50. Realizing that their father was dead, Joseph's brothers said, "What if Joseph still bears a grudge against us and pays us back in full for all the wrong that we did to him?" So they approached Joseph, saying, "Your father gave this instruction before he died. Say to Joseph, I beg you, forgive the crime of your brothers and the wrong they did in harming you. Now therefore, please forgive the crime of the servants of the God of your father." Joseph wept when they spoke to him. Then his brothers also wept, fell down before him and said, "We are here as your slaves." But Joseph said to them, "Do not be afraid. Am I in the place of God? Even though you intended to do harm to me, God intended it for good, in order to preserve a numerous people as he is doing today. So have no fear. I myself will provide for you and your little ones." In this way, he reassured them, speaking kindly to them. Okay, so let's talk a little bit first about the way the brothers approach Joseph.
Mm-hmm.
They are clearly worried.
They're scared. They are scared.
Now that Jacob is sort of out of the way, and so there is no one to intervene with Joseph on their behalf, they're afraid Joseph is going to take his revenge.
Do you think Joseph believes them when they say, "So the last thing Dad said, you weren't in the room, you were out of the room when he said this part, but he said you should definitely forgive us. That's what Dad said." And it just says Joseph wept.
That is an interesting question, because, I mean, we know that these brothers are taken with giving false reports. They have falsely reported the wild beast to their father. Now they're giving a report that only they have access to, and Joseph does not. So I would be inclined to say that he does not believe them. What do you think about that?
I mean, my favorite answer to the question, I think, is it doesn't matter to Joseph whether his father said it or not.
Yeah.
Like, it seems to me that, yes, this is what his father would have wanted. His father would have wanted the strife to end with them. And I almost take the weeping as, you know, sometimes when you just, like, cry with emotion, like, not for a specific reason, like, it's not for a particular thing that causes you sorrow. It's just like, this is their father just died. There's this recognition that, like, without their father there, they need to figure out how to navigate their own relationship.
Yeah.
Joseph is in this tremendously powerful position, and he has to, in this moment, decide what is his relationship to his brothers with his father absent from that. And he has a choice.
I almost read it as he has been overwhelmed by the desire to be reunited with his family.
Yes.
Particularly in light of the loss of his father. And it doesn't matter to him so much sort of how they get there. If his brothers are still deceiving him,
right.
at least they have come back to him and are trying to.
And are begging for forgiveness. They want to have, I mean, I don't know, maybe he imagined that they would steal some food and run away, or say, like, forget it, we don't want it, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Now, there's this beautiful, well, I don't know if it's beautiful, but it's very well crafted irony here, in which what then happens is that the brothers bow down and say, we are here as your slaves, which immediately conjures that dream that we saw all
first.
The way
they
back.
Put on their wheat outfits.
Yeah, they put on their little wheat outfits. They bow down. Yeah. And so here is in the sense, this fulfillment of this dream that Joseph had all the way back in 37, where his brothers are in fact bowing down. But it feels really different right here than it did when we heard the dream in 37. Can you articulate that? Like, why does it feel different to us?
I mean, I think part of the reason it feels different to me is that Joseph doesn't want that anymore.
Yeah.
Like, Joseph doesn't want them to be his slaves. He just wants them to be his brothers.
Yeah.
But the brothers have to be willing to accept the way the story has unfolded, like from soup to nuts. Joseph does have power.
Yeah.
And so the brothers accept it and sort of, you know, go through their process. And I just sort of pictured Joseph saying, like, get up, stop.
Now, I don't know if in your tradition, I assume that it is also true. In my tradition, verse 20 is kind of the most famous part of this story, probably.
Yeah.
Joseph says, even though you intended to do harm to me, God intended it for good. There is so many ways to kind of unpack, like, what on earth that means. Like, are we to go back and say that the brothers throwing him in a pit and selling him into slavery was a good thing? Or what do we do with this statement that he's given us?
You know, I have in my mind a rabbinic teaching about this story that is similar to that idea, but a little more muted in its, like, unbridled joy about about how it all turns out.
Yeah.
So in this rabbinic story, the reason that all of this happens, the reason for this story, is not so that the family can be saved and not, you know, starve to death. The reason is because the Israelites have to get to Egypt.
Mm.
Like, the people Israel has to wind up in Egypt in order for the next part of the story to happen.
Mm.
And so the rabbis tell the story of, like, if you can't get a cow to go wherever it is you want it to go, you take the baby calf and put it wherever it's supposed
to
be, and the mother cow will go to where the baby is. And so that was why all of this had to happen. And so that, to me, does sort of, I mean, it does get to this, like, everything happens for a reason, but it's a little less sort of all rainbows and smiles, because, you know, before their exodus from Egypt, there's going to be 400 years of slavery, you know.
Right.
It's a little more muted, but it is sort of like, it acknowledges this idea that things happen for reasons that you couldn't possibly understand at that time.
No, I like that interpretation a lot. You know, in the Christian tradition, the Apostle Paul in Romans 8 says something that people often interpret similarly, which is, we know that all things work together for good for those who love the Lord. And many people that I know read that as whatever happens to you is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that is not the way to read that. So the things that happened in this story are really awful, but God is such that God can take those terrible things and work something good out of them. So it's not that when something bad happens to us, we ought to think, this isn't such a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's that when something bad happens, we might think, this is a terrible thing, and yet God can bring something good out of this, which in my mind is quite a different mm-hmm. reading.
Yeah, so in that reading, it's not that there was ever a purpose in this suffering happening necessarily. It was just like the suffering happened.
Yeah.
And there can be good yeah. that is born from that. Yeah, no, and that's certainly like almost like putting this particular story aside for a minute. Oh, I mean, maybe we don't even need to do that. That is certainly true of my own experiences of difficulty, is that they are difficult, period, end of story. Like, we know you don't need to only focus on the positive to the extent that you let go of the very real grief of the situation. And there are often things that grow out of that suffering that are in themselves good things.
And in this text, it's not that excuses what the brothers have done or justifies yeah. their actions, or, you know, they can't say, well, I mean, it all turned out fine, so let's not dwell on the past. But Joseph can say that because, you know, he's able now to see, like, despite this terrible thing that you did to me, there's some good that has come out of it. And so I can both remember the bad thing and also celebrate the good thing. And we don't need to dwell on the past, mm-hmm. but nor does that really excuse the past. So we've started to move a little bit toward our closing question, which is, so what do we do with this text in our contemporary lives and in our contemporary communities? You've given us a couple of thoughts about that, but where would you take this in thinking about your own community?
So this past week, I've been thinking a lot about that passage from Deuteronomy that I mentioned back at the beginning of the podcast about sort of when there is a situation with a beloved and a less beloved, Ahuva yeah. and Senua, right? And what it says in Deuteronomy, it's a law of inheritance. It's like how power and wealth has to pass between the generations. And the law that is given is that you have to follow the tradition. You don't get to decide to give more to your Ahuva, to your beloved, than to your Senua, which is understood to be like, you're not favorites. You're not favorite children. You're not favorite wives. You know, the other ones that you yeah. love also. And what I've been thinking about this week, which comes from Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, is the idea that love is incredibly powerful and important and real. And it, in Jacob's life, causes a lot of grief. The uneven distribution of love within a family causes tremendous grief and yeah. conflict and suffering. And so reading this story now with that Deuteronomy passage in my mind, just, I don't know, like, we love who we love. We can't, you know, necessarily control when we have favorites in the world, but we can think about behaving in just ways. And I just can't help but think, reading Jacob's story, the suffering that might have been averted if he had constrained himself from so yeah. obviously showing his preference for yeah. one child over another child, and focus, you know, and focus more on, like, what is this going to look like for the next generation? What is fair? What is just?
Yeah.
Even when that sort of flies in the face of emotion and love, I think those things are intention sometimes. And if I think there needs to be justice before love, you know, you can layer the love on top of the justice.
So as you were talking, one of the things that I was thinking is it seems like we are sort of in a cultural moment where our first inclination is to take care of ourselves and our own, like, to be led by our preferences more than mm-hmm. to ensure that there is justice for everybody in our orbit. And that's such a succinct way of saying that, justice before love.
I think I pretty much stole that from Rabbi Jonathan yeah. Sacks. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He's a wise man.
He is. Yeah. That's beautiful. So I was thinking of this text, I think it's a little bit along similar lines, but as is often the case, in a slightly different direction. And, you know, at its core, this text is a text about scarcity and promise. And, you know, the scarcity is the thing that presents itself in some very tangible ways in this text. There's a scarcity of love, as you're saying, in the
yeah.
family, which creates this tension and strife, which divides people. In the text, in the between 37 and 50, there's a literal scarcity of food, which threatens people's health and well-being. And behind all of that, there is this promise that is going on, that God provides and that God has enough for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a choice that's kind of given to people in this text about whether they're going to live in the scarcity or whether they're going to live in the promise. And that choice is at the beginning of the text, everybody's living, in a sense, into the scarcity, that everybody is struggling over Jacob's love. Everybody is struggling to make sure that they get their equal share, that they get taken care of. At the end of the text, then, of course, you get this whole thing has come together so that Joseph, the one who could be angry and could be bitter about what has happened to him, by the end of the text, he is living into the promise for the family as a whole, doing what is good for his siblings, and trusting that God has a bigger picture in mind about what is yet possible for them. And I just think that's such an important word for our own time, where things seem scarce. Like we're all kind of living at our wits' end, like our batteries are running out and our capacity to care for one another is running out. And it seems like we can either live in the way that's good for one group of people, or we can live in the way that's good for another group of people, or that we perceive to be good for ourselves. And we've lost a sense that maybe really there is abundance. And if we would put justice and like the belief in the sufficiency of the promise mm-hmm. ahead of our own kind of narrow need to feel affirmed ourselves, that maybe we could figure out a way to restore this family, let go of some wrongdoings that have, not that we perceive have happened to us, but have genuinely happened
to us.
Have
actually happened, yes. They happened.
And not to say that they're okay that they happened, but to say mm-hmm. these things happened and they're part of our story and they were terrible things. And we own responsibility for them as the brothers do here, but we need to find a way forward together. That there is the capacity in this story that could in fact happen, grounded in sort of God's generosity, but really relying on human, you know, Joseph has to choose to be generous and mm-hmm. Reuben has to choose to be generous. And they have to choose to live into this possibility of valuing the promise over the appearance of scarcity.
Yeah, that's really beautiful. The scarcity mindset really messes with us.
It does.
It really messes with us. You know, it makes us fight for things we don't need to fight for and wonder about our value in the world and think our value in the world is determined by our share of something that is scarce.
Yeah. And that is true on both a personal familial level and also on a public societal mm-hmm. level. And those two things are deeply interconnected.
Yeah. Beautiful stuff.
All right, Amy. So next week we're going to be in the story of the Passover in Exodus 12 and 13.
And yes, so we will.
I'll see you
then. I'll be here.
All right. See ya.
Bye. Have a good one.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Bible Worm. If you'd like to hear the rest of our conversation about this text, join our Patreon at the Extended Worm level or higher to get access to extended episodes. You'll also find other goodies like early access, video lectures, weekly liturgies, and more, starting at just $4 per month. Visit patreon.com/BibleWormPodcast for details.
We are grateful to all our supporters for helping us keep the podcast going. A special thank you to our executive producer, Fox Valley Presbyterian Church in Geneva, Illinois, and to our newest supporters, Kara Scriven, John Wall, Marie Meeks, Ish Engel, Carol Ann Chapman, Megan Raymer, and Stephen Bond.
Join us again next week when we'll be discussing the story of Passover in Exodus 12 and 13. Until then, keep on digging.